From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're going to start in Rochester, New York, a day after protests erupted after a video was released showing the arrest of Daniel Prude, a 41-year-old black man with mental health problems who died in March after police handcuffed him and held him on the ground. His brother says he called the police after Prude ran into the street after midnight on March 23rd. And then that brother, Joe Prude, spoke with the family yesterday in front of City Hall at a press conference.
How is you sitting here in a push-up stance on my brother's damn neck? How you sitting here with your knee in my brother's damn back when he's defenseless? The video footage gonna show the truth.
Again, Daniel Prude's brother, Joe Prude. Let's bring in reporter Noelle Evans. She's with the radio station WXXI News and joins us by Skype from Rochester. Noelle, I mean, a lot isn't known here. We do know that this video came out yesterday. It is very difficult to watch. You've told us that some reporters had been working on this story before the video came out and this all exploded. Most people didn't know about this story at all. What's been the reaction there?
Immediately after the family, Joe Prude, spoke at a press conference with activists outside of City Hall, activists had gone to the public safety building. As I understand it, there were activists who were protesters who were trying to reach the mayor, who was at a press conference with our chief of police, LaRon Singletary. And a protester was arrested inside the building. I know a total of 9 protesters were arrested yesterday for trespassing, 1 person for inciting riots. So from there, there was a back and forth with police and protesters. Protesters were hitting barricades that were put up around the public safety building. Police fired tear gas, and they had marched to the location where Daniel Prude was killed, and they held a vigil there into the evening.
And we don't know much about that day in March when Daniel Prude was killed. We can see on the body cam footage that police do respond to this call from the brother, find this man obviously struggling with something naked. They eventually call EMTs, but not before handcuffing him and forcing him on the ground. Do we get a sense that they even knew that he was mentally ill? You know, what kinds of exchanges were there?
Yeah. Yes. So from the body camera footage that I saw, Joe Prude spoke with police, who a police officer who came to his house. He said, so Daniel Prude didn't run out naked. He ran out with a tank top and long johns. And so he had said to the police officer that his brother had gone to a local hospital to receive a mental health evaluation because he had displayed some signs of suicidal thoughts. His brother was released, and then a few hours later, his brother asked him to go get a cigarette. His brother went to get the cigarette, and Daniel took off. And when police encountered him, you know, they call out, are you Daniel Prude? He says, yes, sir. And when they handcuff him and he starts to act erratically and begin spitting, they put a spit sock over his head. From there, he was asking repeatedly for a gun, and he started scooting on the ground, and that's when multiple police officers, 2 to 3 police officers, held him down. There's a police officer who is doing, he's holding Daniel's head on the ground. His head is turned sideways, and he has both hands on his head, and he's doing, the position looks like a triangle push-up, so full body weight. As I understand it, that sort of restraint is illegal in New York City. However, it is not banned in New York State.
Look, this is raising a lot of questions. Some cities have special units that respond to calls about mental health. This also goes to police complaints that they're doing too much of what they consider more social work, responding to mental health calls. Either they're not funded for mental health calls, or they are funded to do mental health calls, which in fact others should be doing. All sorts of questions, I'm sure, are going to come up. But we know that the attorney representing the Prude family says they intend to sue everyone responsible for Daniel's death. And your mayor there, Lovely Warren, is questioning the delay in this death being made public, because after the death of Eric Garner, remember, on Staten Island for selling loose cigarettes, your governor there, Andrew Cuomo, made an executive order about in-custody deaths. What was that order? Who was supposed to investigate them?
So any in-custody death in New York State will go to the Attorney General's office.
And so this should have gone to the state.
So Daniel Prude did not die that day. A week after his arrest, Daniel Prude died. And the chief of police has said that once that occurred, the case was handed over to the Attorney General's office.
Okay. Well, we will continue to follow this story. Lots of questions. Reporter Noelle Evans with WXXI Radio. She joins us by Skype from Rochester. Thank you, Noelle.
Thank you so much, Robin.
To France now, where more than a dozen people are on trial in connection with the 2015 attack against the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and a kosher supermarket outside of Paris. 17 people died during 3 days of violence, and the three men who carried out the attacks were also killed. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris, and Eleanor, remind us what sparked these attacks.
Well, this magazine, Charlie Hebdo, it's a satirical magazine, and they're very irreverent, and they poke fun at leaders, especially religious leaders, but they're equal opportunity, let's say, abusers. So what prompted the attacks are they would often have caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. Like there's one example, you have Muhammad crying, and he says, "I just hate it that so many idiots love me." You know, so things like that. And but they also poked fun at the Pope or Moses or Jesus. So anyway, but that, it angered regular Muslims, but it just inflamed so-called radical Muslim Islamists. And two brothers, fed up with the magazine, just stormed the editorial meeting that day, January 7th, 2015, shot the security guard. I mean, this magazine had frequent threats, but you know, no one had ever acted on it. And then they went upstairs in the meeting and literally just slay them in cold blood as they sat around the table planning their next issue of the magazine.
Three attackers were killed, as I mentioned. Who are the people on trial for this crime, and what are they charged with?
Yeah, the people on trial are, well, 11 of them are in the courtroom. Three of them are being tried in absentia. And 10 of them have been brought from prison because they were friends of the three gunmen in prison. They're accused of providing getaway cars, money, guns, safe houses, and things like that. They're expected to say most of them were providing things for Amedi Coulibaly, and he's the gunman who attacked the kosher supermarket. They are expected to say that, yes, we helped him get guns because their fingerprints are actually on these guns. But we thought he was going to do a holdup on a Brinks truck or a bank. We had no idea he was going to do, you know, carry out a terrorist attack. So they're accused of giving them the tools that they needed, the three gunmen, to carry out these attacks.
Hmm. How long is this trial expected to last, and what could the sentences be?
Yeah, the trial is going to last 2.5 months. There are 200 plaintiffs. There's going to be more than 144 witnesses. It's going to be very, you know, emotional and gut-wrenching. Already the coverage is, you know, plunging France back into those terrible 3 days in January 2015. They could be sentenced from 10 years to up to life in prison, but it's going to go on a while, and it's going to be meant to be a cathartic experience. They've been interviewing, you know, the wives of some of the slain cartoonists, family members, and so it's supposed to be a big catharsis for the country.
I mean, this is a really painful moment for France, remembering all of this. You said it's going to be cathartic, but it's also going to open up a lot of wounds.
It is, and it's very strange because we're in such a different time now. You know, you go out in Paris. I went yesterday to the old offices of Charlie Hebdo, and there's a plaque on the wall. I mean, you see the door that the gunman came in, and there's also a mural with the pictures of the cartoonists who were slain. And this trial comes right in the middle of this time when everyone's thinking about, you know, COVID-19. But it does bring people back to that time, which does seem very far away. But and it is very painful. But everyone says we need to go through this. And it's sort of bringing people together to, you know, remembering that time. It's something that is painful, but everyone seems to feel that we need to go through it. We need to be able to come out on the other end and rebuild, you know, our lives and everything.
And Charlie Hebdo actually has a very poignant cover today.
Yeah, well, some might call it poignant. Others may be irritated by it. What they've done is they've said we will not be intimidated or cowed, and they've reprinted some of these cartoons about Muhammad that have inflamed people. And they said, you know, we can blaspheme. You know, French President Emmanuel Macron actually made a speech, and he said, we have the right to, you know, to blasphemize in France. It's part of free speech and freedom of conscience. So they've reprinted these. Some of them were from the Danish newspaper that originally printed them in 2006. And they stand behind them. And, you know, the head of the French Muslim community put out a communique and said, ignore the cartoons and let's just think of the victims. And there was a Muslim policeman who was shot who tried to stop the attackers, and he was shot at point-blank range. Today there's a plaque to him on a boulevard in Paris. So everyone is, that's sort of past. The cartoons are not making controversy today. People are thinking of the victims and of that very difficult time that France lived 5 years ago.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
Over the past week, three people died during protests, one in Portland, Oregon, the other in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Authorities are still investigating the particulars, but what we do know is that in both cases, far-right groups and Trump supporters came face-to-face with racial justice protesters and Antifa activists. And those who've been watching closely to the lead-up of this violence say no one should be surprised. David Nywort is here. He's a journalist, staff writer for The Daily Kos, and author of the forthcoming book, Red Pill, Blue Pill, How to Counteract the Conspiracy Theories That Are Killing Us. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
So, David, let's start with Portland. A member of the far-right group Patriot Prayer was shot and killed during confrontations between Trump supporters and counter-protesters. You've been watching these kinds of clashes play out on the streets of American cities for years. Was it inevitable that it would end up this way?
Yes, I think in a lot of ways it was. Most of the journalists that I've worked with covering this, we weren't sure which side someone was going to get shot on, but we knew we had these extremely volatile events in downtown Portland with a lot of very heated rhetoric flying back and forth and a lot of physical brutality going on between them. And we knew that people were bringing guns to these events, and so it was a matter of eventually somebody was going to get shot, and it did finally happen.
The man who died, Aaron J. Danielson, was a member of Patriot Prayer. Can you remind us what that is?
Patriot Prayer is basically this far-right group. You know, they're led by this guy named Joey Gibson, whose entire reason for being for the last 3 years has been to organize people from rural and suburban and exurban areas to come to these urban areas to hold these events in the hopes of provoking violence.
Joey Gibson, the founder that you just mentioned, I mean, he says that they're not there to incite violence. But what is the goal then that they're saying they're there for?
They have various causes du jour. Rallies in downtown Portland that Gibson has organized have been protests against Portland's sanctuary city status. Patriot Prayer marched in Seattle with people who were marching against Islam. They're very multi-purpose. And when I cover these events, I've sat on the Patriot Prayer side, and they're all just there waiting to get into fights.
Yeah. We should be clear that far-right groups are not the only armed presence at some of these clashes, but to what extent are leftist groups also taking up arms in the streets?
Well, you know, there are anarchists and anti-fascists who do carry weapons. There's in Seattle an outfit called the Puget Sound John Brown Gun Club, but they're pretty much in the minority, in a very tiny number. Whereas on the Proud Boy and Patriot Prayer side, we see a lot of weapons.
Let's go to Kenosha for a moment. Protesters there took to the streets after the shooting of Jacob Blake, as we know. A group of loosely organized armed white men also descended on the city. How do you see this de facto collection of people in the context of more organized groups like Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys? What's the connection there?
Well, they're all connected essentially by this very far-right belief system. It's fundamentally the same sort of paranoid worldview where they fear the New World Order and they believe there's a nefarious cabal of conspirators secretly running the world. And the militias that you see showing up in places like Kenosha are actually organized explicitly to be basically an oppositional force to Black Lives Matter.
This is all at the forefront for all of us in light of what's happening nationally. President Trump visited Kenosha, where he called left-wing protesters domestic terrorists. He then spread conspiracy theories about a plane full of Antifa thugs. Those were falsehoods. We've described the president as ginning up violence in the streets. But this connection to these militias and right-wing extremists go deeper than that.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the ideological common grounds. I mean, a lot of the civil discord that is going on right now really comes down to a kind of epistemic crisis that we are having, where we can't really even agree as a country on what is real and what is fake. We've managed to so disrupt our shared common reality through the arrival of this conspiracy theory sort of media, and the culture that has arrived from that is extremely paranoid, extremely bigoted, and extremely prone to violence.
That's David Nywert, a journalist and author of the forthcoming book, Red Pill, Blue Pill, How to Counteract the Conspiracy Theories That Are Killing Us. David, thank you so much for this conversation.
A pleasure to be here.
On the first day of virtual public school in Los Angeles, 6,000 kindergartners were no-shows. And early numbers show that throughout the country, kindergarten enrollment is down. This data highlights, according to some educators, the need to examine more closely the challenges of remote learning for children and parents during this pandemic. Anna Markowitz is an assistant professor of education at UCLA, and she's been researching this. And Anna, welcome.
Hi.
What's your take on why enrollment is down and why there are so many absences, specifically for kindergarten in say, a place like Los Angeles?
Sure. So something that's important to remember about kindergarten in LA, yes, but sort of across the country, is that only 17 states and the District of Columbia actually require that children go to kindergarten. And the other thing that's interesting about kindergarten is that there's sort of this history of what we refer to as redshirting in kindergarten. And this is when, if you have a kid that's sort of close to the birth date cutoff for going to school, a parent might choose to hold their kid back for a year because they feel like they're not developmentally ready. So I think there's sort of this ethos in history in kindergarten around, is my kid ready for school? Is school getting them the developmental experiences they need? With online school, parents are really concerned that virtual school isn't actually going to get their kids the skills they need. Parents can be really attuned to their kids needing social interactions and kind of learning how to share almost more than sort of learning academic content. And if you talk to a kindergarten teacher, they'll really highlight that those social and emotional skills and self-regulation are just really essential for kindergartners, as well as things like motor skills, activities that are just a lot tougher to get in an online situation. And when you sort of couple that with the fact that parents very legitimately need to be working and are working from home right now and they need care, parents are sort of making this choice to find something else for their kids where they feel like their kids are getting the skills they need and they're getting their kids sort of in a place where they can be a little bit out of the house so they have time to do the work that they need to do as well.
This is so interesting, Anna, because kindergarten is such a rite of passage. And as you said, so much of it has to do with your child having that social, emotional connection with other children in the classroom. Virtual learning sets up an environment where parents also have to be just as much involved with a child, because developmentally at 5 years old, they're probably not likely to be able to sit in front of a computer for long periods of time.
Absolutely. I have several of my friends have said, well, I'm going to send my kid to childcare because there they'll get the sort of practice and the sort of time with other children. And if you talk to preschool teachers, we're collecting some data in some southern states, and the teachers will say, you know, the quality of my classroom interactions with kids is really good. But once we moved to a virtual setting, it was a lot harder to do that. And I know they're not getting the interaction that they need from me as well.
How widespread of a problem does this appear to be? You're looking at this trend beyond LA. You mentioned some schools in the South. What are you seeing?
Yeah, right now I think a lot of it is sort of anecdotal, but you know, we have partners in some work we're doing in Louisiana, and they're talking about childcare centers and places like that experiencing this uptick in older enrollment from kids in kindergarten and first grade whose parents are either sending them to the childcare sort of in lieu of kindergarten or sending them to the childcare to do their online kindergarten. And so it does seem like it's going to be a fairly widespread issue because parents are sort of trying to figure out what's best for their kids right now.
What are the ramifications of young children, particularly kindergartners? You know, there's been a big push over the last few decades to get children into school earlier so that they can have advantages as they move through the system. And what are the ramifications for parents who may not even have access to daycare, overall for education for young people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to highlight again that I think parents are in a really impossible position here where they're sort of asking themselves, what is the best thing to do for my child versus also kind of what is the thing that I need to do to be getting my work done? And so I think we're going to see some real expansion of inequality down the line where, you know, kids are coming into first grade with really, really different preparation for school. And I think the other thing I just want to highlight is this is very tough for all families, but it's going to be really hard for families who have a child with a special need or for families who need access to school services for other reasons.
What kinds of solutions are you seeing or are you recommending at this moment?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard one. I think right now parents are just sort of doing what they need to do. I have friends who are sort of setting up, you know, situations where their kids are going online with another child that they know in the neighborhood. Oftentimes it's sort of someone that they met at the daycare that they were going to before. But I think it's going to be really sort of hyper-local and hyper-individualized solutions. And school districts are going to have to sort of collect the data and see how this plays out a bit more.
That's Anna Markowitz. She's an assistant professor of education at UCLA. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tanya. Have a good day.
A spokesperson for Russian President Vladimir Putin today brushed off German suggestions that the Kremlin was involved in the poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. NPR's Rob Schmitz joins us from Berlin, where Navalny was hospitalized and is in a coma. And Rob, German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Navalny was a victim of attempted murder. Does she back up that claim with evidence?
Well, yes. German doctors have found the nerve agent Novichok in Navalny's system. And what was interesting about the rapidity of this was right after we heard about the results of these tests on Navalny, Angela Merkel had a press conference, and she had unusually strong words for her, for Russia. I mean, she said that Navalny is a victim of a crime that was intended to silence him, and that the poisoning of Navalny goes against Germany and Europe's basic values and laws. She then had some words for Russia's government. She basically said that serious questions remain unanswered and only the Russian government can and must answer them.
Tell us more about what happened and how he ended up in a German hospital. What's his condition and what do doctors say?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, he fell ill on a flight from Siberia to Moscow. And the person who was traveling with him said he had only had drinking one cup of tea at an airport. He was brought to a small town in Siberia, a hospital there. While he was there, there was this fight between German officials and Russian officials to send Navalny to Germany. That fight was eventually won by the Germans, and he was taken a few days later to Berlin, where he's been ever since. And he's, you know, this whole time he's been in a coma. But doctors here in Berlin say that the poison in his system has receded over time, but they're not sure whether this will have long-term consequences on his health.
How has this impacted German-Russian relations?
Well, this has been a pretty bad year for German-Russian relations. About a year ago, a Russian man assassinated a former Chechen military commander in broad daylight here in Berlin, not too far from where I stand. German prosecutors say there is strong evidence that Russia was behind that, and Germany expelled Russian diplomats late last year as a response to this. Merkel is also frustrated with Russia because Germany believes that Russian intelligence has hacked her personal email. Another point of contention is that Merkel has taken a very firm stance on the unrest in Belarus, and that's irked Putin, who warned her and the EU not to interfere in Belarus's domestic affairs.
Russia and Germany have close energy ties. They're building this pipeline, another one. Could this project be in jeopardy?
I don't think so. You know, what's interesting here is that behind this very contentious political relationship between Germany and Russia, there is a crucial economic one. Germany depends on Russia for more than a third of its natural gas, and that dependence is going to grow when this additional pipeline called Nord Stream 2 is expected to be finished in the coming months. So I don't think that something like this could have an impact on a project that's been planned for many, many years and will benefit not only Russia and its largest energy company, but also Germany.
That's NPR's Rob Schmitz in Berlin. Rob, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
Let's turn to news yesterday that the CDC sent notices to states telling them to prepare for a coronavirus vaccine possibly by November. Election day is the 3rd, and there's concern that a vaccine may not be fully tested or safe, and that even if it is, even a whiff of politics will erode trust in it. There are two vaccine candidates, A and B, and their description aligns with the two furthest along in the trial process, one from Moderna, the other Pfizer, both relying on so-called messenger RNA to get protective antibodies into the vaccinated. Bill Gruber is Pfizer's senior vice president of clinical research and development. 30,000 people are in what's supposed to be their long-term phase 3 trial, but that will be shortened for the November date. The goal, to find out if it's safe, but also if it prevents people from picking up COVID-19. So, Bill, is yours one of the vaccines?
Yeah, I'm not sure which one is A or B, but we certainly are one of the vaccines in contention to deliver on a November 1st date, and we're still working very hard to achieve that goal.
Well, do you think you'll be ready?
We're working really hard in that respect. Recruitment has gone incredibly well, and the safety profile looks very similar to what we saw in phase 1, recognizing, of course, that we're blinded. We don't know who is receiving vaccine and who is not. 50% of the population receives vaccine and the other 50% receives a placebo.
So talk more about phase 3. You say you're pleased with how it's going. Why? What do you see? We know that you've got 50% of the 30,000 people who are getting the vaccine, 50% are getting a placebo. What is it that you're seeing that you're liking?
First of all, our highest priority is demonstrating that the vaccine is safe and well tolerated. And even though we're, of course, blinded to the results, the reactions that we're seeing after vaccine are very similar to what we saw in phase 1. So the vaccine looks to be that it will likely be well tolerated and safe. The other thing that we do is that everybody who enrolls in the trial either receives in a blinded fashion two doses of the vaccine or two doses of placebo. And once that's done, we monitor them to see if they actually acquire circulating COVID-19 or circulating SARS coronavirus 2 that produces COVID-19. So we're watching to see if they catch the virus in the community. And then we use that information to determine, are there fewer numbers of individuals that catch the virus or receive the vaccine or not? Now, how do we do that? We obviously have to remain blinded during the early phases of the trial until we get to the end. And so we have what's called a data monitoring committee, and some people refer to it as a data safety and monitoring board, who have the ability to look in an unblinded way, independent of us. We have no idea. And at particular time points in the trial, they can say, you do not have to go any further with this trial. You've already shown efficacy, and you have sufficient safety to actually declare success.
Well, fighting off COVID-19 is fantastic. That's the goal. But what about side effects and long-term effects? I've mentioned to you already that the spouse of one of our colleagues is one of your 30,000 participants in the trial. He happens to be a doctor. He experienced severe vertigo, nausea, diarrhea, a headache for several days. He couldn't stand at one point, all of which he said he expected. And he actually doesn't mind. He still thinks it's important to be in this trial. And he still has faith in this vaccine. But he said it would be irresponsible and ethically wrong to release it before the trials are completed. Do you have the same concerns?
Yeah, I think, again, our goal is to obviously do our very best in collaboration with regulatory authorities to assure a safe and effective vaccine. We very closely monitor the nature of reactions to the vaccine. And again, let me express my appreciation for your colleague's husband for participating in this trial, because, of course, we can't guarantee ahead of time that the vaccine will be effective. But we do monitor safety very closely, not only for the short term, but this study is designed to follow these individuals out to 2 years.
But Bill, 2 years out is too late for people who might be taking the vaccine as early as November. And it's going to be given first to first responders, people who are the most at risk. How do you offset the concerns that this is political, that the President of the United States wants to have a vaccine by Election Day? Will Pfizer refuse to release the doses if you don't think it's ready?
Yeah, I think, certainly we can confidently say that we will only move forward to release a vaccine if we and regulatory authorities and those that are going to be making the recommendations.
Do you trust the government regulatory authorities and people making this decision?
Yeah, let me be clear. Again, our approach is no different than we would take for any other vaccine in terms of following the rules that the FDA has required. The FDA has, provided guidance in terms of the size of a safety database that's required to release a vaccine based on just the safety component. I can't speak to the politics beyond the FDA, but the nature of what we choose to do is to follow the FDA rules. I'm hopeful that that will be the basis for licensure. The FDA is going to actually hold at least one meeting, maybe more, that is actually going to set the ground rules for what's going to be required. That, I understand, is going to occur towards the end of October.
Well, many listeners are thinking this is the same FDA that okayed convalescent plasma and then had to pull that back because they were wrong and misinformed and politically pushed. So that's a concern. Look, I know that's not your wheelhouse, so let's go to what is. Are you at all concerned about some other requirements for your vaccine in particular? We know it needs more refrigeration than, let's say, the Moderna. Are you confident that centers across the country are going to be able to build that infrastructure in time?
There's no question that it is more challenging the circumstance where you have to maintain a vaccine in a frozen state. I think the nature, we may have to think differently, about how we manage vaccination in a pandemic setting. And I'm old enough to have experienced what was referred to as Sabin on Sunday, where, I lined up along with other children and adults to receive live poliovirus vaccine at my school. So for pandemic planning, I think we need to think carefully about how we would, provide vaccines at site. We've identified ways to maintain the cold chain and the packaging so we can deliver vaccine to site that would be stable and could be, delivered to individuals.
We can also look back at 2009, the H1N1 pandemic vaccination campaign, and the CDC has pointed this out as well. There weren't enough doses. We understand you have about 1 million.
We're anticipating that by the end of the year, we would have 100 million doses, just to be clear, and that we have an agreement with the government for about 600 million doses, as I understand it, for next year. So, but you, to the general point that, yes, there are less doses than obviously we would ideally like to be able to vaccinate the entire population of the United States, much less the world. We'll need to make some, tough decisions about who will get this vaccine first. And we're obviously going to, support those decisions in terms of how our vaccine would be delivered if it's proved safe and effective.
You mentioned the world and your thoughts on news that we just heard that the Trump administration has decided against joining a global effort to come up with a vaccine, essentially because it involves the WHO and that President Trump thinks that the WHO is China-centric.
I can't speak to the politics, but I think, it's our goal to be able to provide vaccine to the United States and as we can manage the production issues to much of the rest of the world. We're clearly going to be dependent on more than one manufacturer.
How are you feeling right now about this possibility?
Oh, I'm feeling very optimistic. Obviously, I can't promise success, but the recruitment has gone well. We're still on target to deliver a potential efficacious vaccine. If all goes incredibly well and we have high efficacy, and hopefully, if the vaccine is efficacious, we'll be able to declare success and also prove to the public that the risk-benefit in terms of the safety profile favors the population receiving this vaccine.
That's Bill Gruber, Senior Vice President of Clinical Research and Development for Pfizer, one of the two vaccines that the government is telling states to prepare for because they might be ready very soon by early November. Bill, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The roar of the crowds and the energy of thousands of people gathering to watch sports together won't be happening anytime soon, even though teams have now figured out how to actually play. That's the case for the U.S. Open tennis tournament in New York, nothing but empty seats. And there won't be any cheering fans at the Kentucky Derby at Churchill Downs on Saturday. Mike Pesca is a sports analyst for Here and Now, and he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, Iowa State University had also said it planned to play a football game with 25,000 fans next weekend, but reversed that decision yesterday. Is there going to be any college or pro football played with fans in attendance?
Well, I think we might see other instances like that, what happened with Iowa State. And let's remember, Iowa State plays in the Big 12 and University of Iowa plays in the Big 10. There is no Big 10 football. So we're talking about schools a couple hundred miles away from each other. One has decided football of any kind, not safe. The other one decided, okay, maybe we could have fans, but we can't. I did look at the NFL. And it seems like on a case-by-case basis, different teams are either saying, no, there shall be no fans, or they'll be, and the general rule of thumb is something like 25% of capacity. So the Super Bowl winning Chiefs, the Indianapolis Colts will have something like 25% of capacity. But who knows if that'll come to pass? I was looking at the Kansas City numbers and the health officials there were warning of spiking numbers in the area. The Florida football teams, where the outbreak is certainly not contained, are announcing that they're going to have fans in the stands. But, you know, who knows if they'll follow through with that when games start in early September.
The NBA and NHL are also playing in their bubbles, and the playoffs are getting really serious now. What's jumping out to you about these games?
Well, the theme of the NHL playoffs, your Boston Bruins have gone down to the Lightning. But in every other series that's going on, all the teams that are facing elimination have so far staved it off. The Flyers down 3-1 to the Islanders, staved off elimination. Vancouver down 3-1 to Las Vegas, staved off elimination. And Colorado against Dallas, Colorado staved off elimination twice. It's a great day for staving. In the NBA, there were two Game 7s, one last night. The Houston Rockets beat the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Thunder had a surprising season. They were predicted to be one of the worst teams in the NBA. I do have to say this was overall an exciting and close game, but with all the reviews that are available because of technology and all the stops and starts and commercials, I timed the last 2.7 seconds of that game. It lasted almost 13 minutes. That is something that the NBA should look at in terms of the fan experience.
Wow. Yeah. I want to turn to something else right now while I have you. So the pandemic, of course, has coincided with this movement against racism and police brutality against Black men and women, and athletes and leagues are stepping up. What's the latest on that?
Well, the NFL is going to have some sloganeering in their end zones, but I think a big development is that Steve Nash was hired as coach of the Brooklyn Nets, and he's a great player. He was a great player, and he's a brilliant mind. But he's never coached before, and I mention this because he's white, and they overlooked, the Nets did, an assistant coach, Jacques Vaughn, who was black. And the general trend in the NBA, which actually gets high marks from the organizations that look at this, they're very good compared to all other sports in terms of black hiring. But if you look at black head coaches, they're down to just a handful, and the number of more than cut in half since 2014. So this is an issue, I think, that the NBA, which is looking at society, rightly so, needs to do some focusing on itself.
Yeah, before I let you go, we want to note that two Hall of Famers died this week, former Georgetown basketball coach John Thompson and the great pitcher Tom Seaver. I know that you, you're a Mets fan. Your thoughts on Tom Seaver and John Thompson?
Well, Tom Seaver's greatness preceded my fandom in life a little bit. They won the World Series with him before I was born. But he is by far the greatest Met of all time. And he was the only member of the Baseball Hall of Fame with a Mets hat. That's the big thing, what team that you affiliate with. Later, Mike Piazza joined wearing the Mets hat. He also made the Hall of Fame with 99% of the vote. This was at a time when there was always one or two cranky holdout who would never vote for you. Since then, Ken Griffey Jr., Mariano Rivera got 100%, but he really just is one of the greatest pitchers of all time, and it's gutting to Mets fandom, which is wide and diverse.
Yeah, and John Thompson.
You know, I was a fan of St. John's, which is the rival of John Thompson, so I hated John Thompson, but it was a hatred born of just grudging respect. He was a great coach, a great recruiter, and he took social stands that at the time drew some criticism. For instance, he boycotted a game because of the NCAA requiring certain SAT scores to earn a scholarship. And I think history has proved him right on that stance. And I have to say, when I was 10 or 11 and he did this, I was just a grumpy anti-Georgetown fan.
Yeah,
but I gotta admit, he was right. I was wrong. But I was 10.
Mike Pesca is here and now, sports analyst, and he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, as always, thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young, and that's the last time Mike was wrong when he was 10. It's Here and Now.
President Trump has incorrectly attributed a rise in crime in some cities to Democrats.
All of these problems are Democrat cities. We don't want to say it, but it is. The top 10 are Democrat. Then you go into the top 25 and take a look at that. It's the same thing.
But homicides are up in Republican-led cities, too. We'll break down the crime numbers. That's next time on Here and Now.